This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. GMOs, genetically modified organisms, are a controversial topic in food. Supporters of GMO crops say they boost the food supply and lower the costs of food when seeds are engineered with resistance to pests. Critics of GMOs say the foods themselves are bad for human health and the environment. And when the public is trying to determine GMO food, good or bad, there are multitudes of conflicting studies and reports to draw from that bolster one side of the debate or another. This month, a report from the National Academy of Sciences sought to clarify the debate. A team of researchers pored over data from previous studies and summarized it in a substantial report that's written for the public and policymakers to digest. We spoke with Fred Gould, the North Carolina State University scientist who chaired the committee, about what his team found.
We were 20 people who worked for 2 years on this, and we came up with our own assessment. But deep in this is a 400-page report with over 1,000 references to papers, both pro and con and in between, and we wanted to make sure that people could access it. And there's a place in that report where we had received 700 inquiries or comments from the public, and we tried to address those. And you can click on any one of those comments and see how we responded to those comments, and you can decide for yourself.
You know, I guess not surprisingly, though, since the report has come out, you've been both applauded and criticized from people on all different sides. Depending on where you're looking, if you're not a person who's actually reading the report, you could be very confused about what the report's conclusions are. So what's your assessment?
There are a few things. One is that we start off by saying that to make sweeping generalizations about genetically engineered crops is impossible because some genetically engineered crops make them resistant to herbicides. So you can spray specific herbicides. And if the herbicide that you can now spray is dangerous, well, that's a problem, right? But, and then you can conclude that's a bad genetically engineered product. But if you have another genetically engineered product that increases the beta-carotene content of rice, and this could help people who have vitamin A deficiency ward off blindness, well, maybe you'd see that as a positive. But you can't conclude from either one of those that all GE crops are either good or bad. It depends on the specifics. So that's a major thing that, you know, we try to emphasize here is that people try to, you know, do this broad brush approach and that it's becoming less and less tenable. It's also becoming less and less technically tenable to distinguish between genetically engineered crops and conventionally bred crops. So I use the analogy that in 1996, when genetically engineered crops first came out, you know, at that time, the analogy is if you had a laptop computer and a cell phone at that time, it would be pretty clear to you what you'd want to use your cell phone for and what you'd want to use your laptop for. But today, if you have a cell phone, it can probably do all the things that your 1996 laptop can do as well as what your cell phone could do then. So in 1996, there was a very clear distinction between genetically engineered crops and conventionally bred crops in that genetically engineered crops were a specific thing where you had a transgene, a gene from something other than that plant that was put into the plant using genetic engineering techniques. And the conventionally bred crops were mostly crops that were made by crossing different plants of the same species, although people used radiation and mutagenesis that was still considered conventional breeding. Today, we're in a different situation where people who are doing genetically engineering of crops are sometimes just changing a single amino acid in one variety of crops to match what that amino acid base pairs would be in another variety of that same crop. And people who use mutagenesis breeding could, using other genomic approaches, come up with a crop that was herbicide resistant to the same herbicide that the genetically engineered crop was resistant. So you wind up with a blurring of that distinction. And we want to make that point because we want to focus people on the fact that you could make a genetically engineered crop that is very different than anything that existed before, and that would be very novel and important to analyze very carefully. But if you made a change using genetic engineering that just made variety A have a similar allele or gene to variety B, That's pretty different. The other thing that we point out is that not only did the techniques for genetically engineering a crop change since 1996, so did the techniques for analyzing the genetically engineered crops and conventionally engineered crops change. So the FDA asks companies to submit data on 60 different characteristics of the new crop that they want to put on the market. With the new high-throughput technologies, you can analyze thousands of characteristics to get basically a fingerprint of the new crop and a fingerprint of the crop before that to see if there really are any intended or unintended changes. So the focus should, you know, we say at least, should be more on the actual characteristics of the plant, not on the genes that were changed, because change in a small number of genes can lead to a big change in the characteristics of a plant, and big changes in the genes can lead to a small change. So really, it's what you're eating that matters, right? So you want to analyze what you're eating.
One of the other things that your study found was a lack of proof of detriment to human health. And that's not the first time we've heard that. There have been many studies that have shown that GMO crops don't negatively impact human health. So when you were looking at that, was it just to confirm the data that you were trying to get to that point, or to see if there was something else that you could show people?
Yeah, so actually, you know, we knew that there were all these studies out there, but we also knew that there were studies out that claimed that there were effects. So we started out at the beginning in our committee to move ourselves to really reexamine the data. And if you look through the one chapter on health effects, there's over 200 references on in that chapter, because we went back to the initial literature and looked at those studies. But also, we did a first look at the epidemiology in human populations. So since 1996, people in the U.S. and Canada have been eating genetically engineered crops, but people in the U.K. and in Western Europe and the EU have not been. So are there any differences in chronic diseases in these two different groups? And we went through that data and didn't find any differences. And again, all that information is in the report, and you can click on specific questions and take a look at those graphs and data for yourself.
When you add that at the end, this idea that people can go and look for themselves, I'm interested because, not that you sound defensive in a pejorative way, but my hunch is that you get a lot of pushback on specifically that area of the report.
Well, we get pushback on all areas of the report, but I'd like to be open about this in the sense that often people are given these kind of authoritative reports, and we'd like our report to be the beginning of a conversation, not the end of it. I'd love to have, you know, people have book clubs, right, and they read books and go through them. You can go through our chapter on health effects and discuss it with your friends.
You know, I can't imagine a lot of book groups in America choosing this particular 400-page report, but I like the idea.
You know, let's say choose that one chapter or choose a piece. You know, people talk about it all the time, but they don't have access for themselves to the information. And I understand that maybe that's less interesting than a novel, but you know, you just go into a grocery store and overhear a conversation about people talking about these things, but we want them at least to have the access to the information.
So again, with the understanding that you're not trying to put a stamp on this is the truth about genetically engineered crops, you did find that in some cases you may be seeing an increase in certain weeds while you may be seeing a decrease in certain insects. And I'd love for you as an entomologist to talk about what you're seeing as the effects on insects.
Right. Well, that is true. That's my area, is the entomology area. And what's interesting is, you know, you could argue that we should all do organic agriculture, but that's not being done. And there's a lot of insecticide being sprayed, and it's called broad-spectrum insecticides because it kills the pests and natural enemies at the same time. The protein that's being put into the plants comes from Bacillus thuringiensis, a bacteria that was used by organic farmers. You know, I mean, I don't want to defend, you know, like whether the company should be doing this or not. But the bottom line is that when you have a corn plant out that has this toxin from the BT bacteria, it is very specific to a few pests and is not going to have as big an impact on the natural enemy. So when people survey fields that were conventionally bred crops treated with insecticides versus the ones with the genetically engineered crops, people typically find more natural enemies in the genetically engineered crops. The resistance issue is a big thing for an entomologist because we have worked hard to try to get regulations passed to not overuse those crops so that resistance wouldn't evolve. And the EPA has regulations, and it seems to me that when they're followed, the pests haven't evolved resistance. With the herbicides, there's been so much use of one herbicide that it's not surprising that the weeds are evolving resistance to them.
And this is glyphosate?
That's glyphosate, yes.
So that could be a problem moving forward.
Well, that is a problem now. In North Carolina, where I live, this is a problem for farmers. But an issue to bring up is, of course, if we never had genetically engineered crops with resistance to glyphosate, the farmers in North Carolina would probably still be using herbicides that are more problematic to the environment and human health than the glyphosate is. So it's a mixed bag. And again, in the report, we didn't find evidence of health effects of the currently engineered crops, and we didn't find real environmental disruption from the currently engineered crops. So, I mean, one thing that, of course, this led to with the health effects is that we said we didn't see health effects. And there's these issues about labeling that, of course, come up. And the FDA keeps saying, oh, we can't label this because it's not part of our mandate. If there's nothing substantially different between two kinds of food, we don't label it. And, you know, we say in the report we didn't see that difference. But we also say in our report that there are lots of reasons why governments label specific kinds of foods. And in the U.S., the FDA does have limits on its authority, but state and national governments don't. So there have been laws passed for mandatory labeling on things like country of origin of products, whether something is artificial flavoring or natural flavoring. So the committee makes a comment that based on health issues, we don't see a reason for labeling. But based on other reasons, it's up to society to make those decisions.
Fred Gould is a professor of entomology at North Carolina State University and chairman of the committee that just produced the big new report on GMO crops from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. Fred, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.